From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made earlier today when three more nations announced that they will formally recognize an independent Palestinian state. This comes as hundreds of thousands of Palestinians continue to flee the ongoing Israeli siege. There are varying estimates of fatalities, but we know that thousands are dead. Many of the dead and wounded have been children. Israel has said that Hamas is to blame, not only for the October 7th attack, but for years of neglecting the Palestinian people and building its bases of operation inside civilian structures. Here's how the New York Times described today's development. Quote, Spain, Norway, and Ireland said on Wednesday that they would recognize an independent Palestinian state, a rebuke to Israel that, though largely symbolic, reflected dwindling international patience with its military offensive in Gaza and its decades of occupation of Palestinian territories. Scores of countries have recognized Palestinian statehood, but the closely coordinated announcements by the three nations today carried added weight amid the growing toll of the war in Gaza, and because most Western European countries have resisted taking such a step out of solidarity with Israel. The moves will likely have little immediate effect on conditions for Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank or in Gaza, where health authorities say that more than 35,000 people have been killed in over 7 months of Israeli bombardment and ground combat. More than 140 countries and the Holy See have recognized a Palestinian state, but most Western European countries and the United States have not, end quote. Here in the United States, protests have taken root in dozens of communities and many college campuses. In recent weeks on this program, we've heard from a range of voices, many Jewish voices. Census figures show that in our region, there are hundreds of people with Palestinian roots. And today we hear from some of them. My guests this hour include Jonathan Corey, who is a Palestinian organizer with the Rochester Committee to End Apartheid. Jonathan, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Halima Awais is with us, an organizer with the Rochester Committee to End Apartheid and a student at the University of Rochester. Halima, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Joshua Dubler is with us. Joshua is an associate professor of religion at the University of Rochester and a member of U of R's chapter of Faculty for Justice in Palestine. Welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
I just want to start by asking all of you, by the way, we'll have a fourth guest joining us later this hour. I want to start by asking all of you just to describe if you want to take some time to describe what the recent months have been like for you, not only given your own background, the work that you've done, the roots that some of you have, but knowing that there is not necessarily an end in sight to what we are seeing. Jonathan, I'll start with you.
Gut-wrenching is perhaps the first word that comes to mind. Heartbreaking, devastating, infuriating, paralyzing. There's really a limitation of expressions or words to effectively describe what this experience has been like, the experience of witnessing slaughter of your people, the experience of witnessing people calling for that slaughter, actually locally and internationally, wanting to see it continue under some strange guise of, you know, the defense of a country, which is illegitimate under international law. It has been absolutely world shattering for so many of us who have family in Palestine, who have friends from Gaza, who have had to listen to the countless stories of what has happened to their family members, whether they have been lost or brutalized or now sustained some long-term injury that will impact them for the rest of their days. There really, truly is not a way to effectively encapsulate what this experience has been like.
Halima?
I would echo everything Jonathan just said. I think the last several months have been nothing short of grief and exhaustion and just extreme sadness to not only see this ongoing slaughter and genocide of the Palestinian people, but then to somehow carry on with your daily life as if it's not happening, and to somehow carry on seeing the headlines completely misconstruing what is happening. It's exhausting and it's frustrating. And then to attend a university, the institution I go to, University of Rochester, and to see the way they've treated us for trying to speak up for this, the way we've seen them try to silence us and to restrict our ability to simply protest and say, hey, we don't stand with this and we want something to be done about it. So it's been a very long several months is what I'll say.
What's an example of the way the headlines misconstrue things as you see it?
That's a great question. I think the way they continuously refer to Israel as this defensible nation, as if they are continuing to not only defend themselves, but they're doing this as an act of justice, to that they are trying to wipe out terrorism from the Middle East, that they are, that the way they can, the way the headlines continually refuse to correctly identify the number of Palestinians lost, the way the headlines refuse to acknowledge Palestine as an entity. I've seen headlines that just call it the Israeli region and don't say Palestine at all. I think that in and of itself is a gross misconstrual of what's happening here. There is Palestine. It's always been Palestine. And so I think at bare minimum, refusing to call it that and refusing to acknowledge the identity of these people, these millions of people based there, it's abhorrent.
And just to follow up on that, I think it's important to acknowledge the way that this is often described as a war. It's the Israeli-Hamas war, which, as I've just previously stated, is a really illegitimate context under international law. Israel is an occupying entity, and they occupy the regions that Palestinians exist in currently. Under international law, they are charged with protecting the Palestinian people. They are charged with ensuring that humanitarian aid can make it through to the Palestinian people. Therefore, this is not a war. This is not a war between Israel and Hamas as though they are two countries. This is a siege. This is a genocide against the people that Israel is charged with protecting under international law.
You know, I would add, Evan, I don't know how you would assess NPR's coverage of the last 7 months, right? But I don't watch cable news, but legacy media like the New York Times and the Atlantic, I think it's fair, it's incontrovertible to say that they have been manufacturing consent for genocide. So only one example is that in late January, when the International Court of Justice imposed its provisional measures against Israel by votes of 15-2 and 16-1, the New York Times had queued up, no doubt with Israeli intelligence assistance, the story of the 12 UNRWA volunteers who were involved in October 7th, which of course was later discredited. But this was simply an Israeli intelligence counteroffensive that was laundered by legacy media. On the domestic front, what you've had, and it's been absolutely infuriating, is powerful forces, you know, beginning with the Anti-Defamation League's Brandeis letter of October 17th, propped up by Joe Biden and Kathy Hochul, powerful forces that are looking to criminalize protest in this country, looking to paint protesters who are protesting for liberation and are using their First Amendment rights to endlessly paint them as motivated by anti-Semitism and falsely slandering them as calling for the genocide of the Jews. It's the normative public discourse is tantamount to a false reality.
Well, on that note, let me then just ask, because part of the discourse, especially in Western media, is shaped by questions about, for example, Hamas. This comes up in almost every interview, you know, whether it's with Israeli leadership or with activists, with protesters, et cetera. And I feel somewhat paralyzed when I look at the situation, trying to understand. What does the other side, I mean, obviously, step one seems to be whenever the Israeli siege ends. But is there a future for the Palestinian people with Hamas leadership? Is that the right question? What does that look like going forward? What do you think, Jonathan?
I think that Hamas is a political party that was elected in Gaza. I think that it is false to suggest that they are the political party that represents all Palestinian people. I also think that the focus on Hamas is a red herring from the current genocide and the ongoing occupation and theft of Palestinian land and the brutality and the apartheid that Palestinians have to suffer through. So I cannot speak to what the future with any political party looks like in the same way that I am unable to speak to what the future under a political party here in the U.S. looks like. But what I can say is that the focus on Hamas and using Hamas as a leverage or as a talking point when referring to the ongoing genocide and apartheid of the Palestinian people is simply just a false equivalency, right? And it's, I think, important to acknowledge that Palestinians often are asked this question. We often have to grapple and answer for the actions of a political party, and yet we don't see the same thing happening for either Jewish or Israeli counterparts, right? There is the Goldstein terrorist attack that occurred in the 80s that unleashed terror against Palestinians in the masjid, in the mosque. Never are Jewish or Israeli people asked to account for, you know, what it looks like under Zionist leadership in the future or under a Zionist regime in the future. So this question is something that I feel generally when asked is asked in such a way that really propagates anti-Palestinian racism. It's not a question that we see being asked on the other end.
So let me just say, from a journalistic standpoint, I understand that not only that argument, and I do see what you're saying manifested in a lot of media sources. But I certainly have seen all kinds of direct questioning about how can Israeli leadership continue under the Netanyahu government, especially when it appears that whenever the siege in Gaza ends, the Netanyahu government is probably done. And for, you know, a lot of young people, there hasn't been an Israeli leadership without Benjamin Netanyahu. And he has preserved his power through all kinds of means, perhaps including now the extension of suffering and the siege. And so I think that those questions are vital on all sides. And I would just say, I understand very much, and I want to give you more time to describe why you get frustrated with questions about Hamas that you think seem to deflect or take attention away from, as you see, the real issue. I do understand that. I tend to think that we can do both and. We can talk about, are we concerned about the Palestinian people if this party continues to maintain power? Have they served the people well? Are they concerned about average Palestinians? And if they are not, is there a mechanism for future elections and a future direction for Palestinians, especially in Gaza, but for Palestinians and people in general? Just as the question must be asked in Israel, what is the kind of leadership that actually supports peace and equality and an end of suffering? And I don't necessarily hear that as much. I agree with that. But I certainly do hear questions about how does Israel continue under this government? So I guess part of what I'm asking is, can we do both and, or do you think that is essentially a distraction, that that should not be part of the conversation? Which is, I'm just asking what you think is fair.
Yeah, so I do think it is a distraction. And I think so because, again, Hamas is not the political party that leads all Palestinian people. They are in Gaza right now. To suggest that the question of Hamas leadership being the focus for Palestinian people's future ignores completely that there is no Hamas in the West Bank, first of all, right? It also ignores, in terms of asking the question of have they serviced the Palestinian people well, what about Israel, who is legally charged to ensure the safety and to ensure the safe entry of humanitarian aid to the Palestinian people? Those are the primary questions that we need to be asking. Focusing on Hamas is to recontextualize and try and create an ahistoric version of the current genocide that we are seeing that neglects the 1948 Nakba, the initial dispossession, violent dispossession and brutality against the Palestinian people, ignores the blockade being erected in Gaza in 2014, ensuring that they could not effectively bring in resources, ignores the dire circumstances that they have been experiencing since that Hamas is not responsible for, that the Israeli regime continues to be responsible for. I think the focus, therefore, must be on Israel. And I also think that the Israeli government under Netanyahu, I don't know how important Netanyahu is to this question. The violence that Palestinian people have been experiencing has preceded Netanyahu. It started 76 years ago on May 15th, 1948. That is the focus.
Let me ask your colleagues if they want to add to that. Halima?
I couldn't have said it better myself. I think it's a distraction. I think at this moment in time, what we're seeing is an unrelentless siege and genocide. And I think to attempt to, you know, I hear you, and I think it's important to think about what the future for Palestinians look like. I think the future for Palestinians at this moment, all that they can hope and wish for is an end to the siege, is an end to the genocide, and the ability to wake up without bombs flying overhead, is the ability for pregnant women, there are 60,000 pregnant women who are suffering unimaginable conditions, 200 of them giving birth with no type of care, no type of anesthesia, nothing. And so I think all that they can possibly ask for is for it to stop at this moment and then possibly reassess. And I think just like any citizens of any nation, they should have the ability to contribute to that conversation. They should have the ability to weigh it amongst themselves, see if a new political party wants to emerge. They should have the opportunity for that type of, you know, basis to become fruitful, for them to have that conversation. But they cannot yet. They simply cannot have that conversation yet, because at this moment, they're fighting for their lives. At this moment, they are sleeping on the ground, and they don't have the ability to think of that possible future yet.
I'll add, you know, as an American taxpayer and as an American Jew, my primary focus is on the abject failure of the Biden administration in authorizing this genocide. And my secondary preoccupation is with the Israeli state that is conducting this genocide in some sense in my name. I think most people who ask about Hamas don't want to know. I think that they're fine with their Facebook level knowledge that Hamas is a terrorist organization, which is, again, basically like the knowledge that Joe Biden seems to have. I would recommend a book called Hamas Contained by Tariq Bakoni, which I learned a lot about the history of the organization, and we're hoping to bring him to the U of R next year. I will say that non-state violence, non-state violent actors, when states come into being, those quote unquote terrorists, whether it's this country or whether it's Mandate Palestine or whether it's Ireland, those people become the government. That's how things tend to work. You know, I think that the unlevel playing field, Israeli state violence is normalized and never questioned. Israel has the right to defend itself, even though it does not, under international law, have the right to defend itself against occupied territories. And Palestinian resistance is always seen as excessive and illegitimate. I'm 49 years old. I was raised in Zionist institutions. The things that are said today about Hamas, as if it's somehow some kind of exception, the exact same things were said about the PLO when I was a child. And that was a secular nationalist organization. So I think the question, it indicates more about the questioner and how the questioner isn't interested in the answer.
So let me ask our guest then, you know, you heard Halima say that, number one, there has to be an end to the siege.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, is there an appetite and interest in a two-state solution? It feels in my lifetime like there is less of a hope and an emphasis on that than ever before. That's an observation from a layperson who is not an expert and is not intimately involved in this. I mean, I want to put that on the table. I've said before, and I will say this again, I don't necessarily feel qualified to be having these conversations. These are very difficult conversations, and I want to continue to elevate voices from all different perspectives. And there are going to be times that these conversations are uncomfortable, and there's going to be times where they need to be uncomfortable. But I'm going to do my best just to ask honest questions. And so when I say I don't even know what the appetite for a two-state solution is, I don't know if our guests here feel that that is in range, desirable, achievable, or even sort of relevant to the moment here. And I'll go back around the table. Halima, what do you think?
I'm going to actually defer to my colleagues this one.
Sure. Jonathan?
Yeah, I think that a two-state solution has always been predicated on the violent dispossession and removal and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. There's not a single time that we have been able to see the establishment of an Israeli state that did not depend on the violent removal and slaughter of Palestinians, starting from, again, 1948, the Nakba. This is a time where Palestinian villages were ravaged. They were destroyed. 70,000 Palestinians were displaced. A countless number were slaughtered and murdered. This is what Israelis refer to as Israeli Independence Day, May 15th, 19, the darkest day in our history. I am unaware of what a two-state solution looks like for a state whose existence is predicated on these facts, is predicated on our violent removal and our actual absence from the land. That's not to say that there's no interest or no appetite for it. However, historically speaking, I am not seeing that there's any real good faith intention to establish a two-state solution. The intention has very clearly been to remove Palestinians from the land and to take the land entirely. And we see that with the ongoing occupation of land and territory and the theft of that occupied territory that was allocated to Palestinians since 1967. So
what would a good faith process perhaps either result in or look like then?
So the Israeli democracy, which is a farce, completely depended on the removal of the ethnic majority at the time, which was Palestinian people, and blockading them into the West Bank, Gaza, or removing them from the region entirely, right? An attempt, let's say theoretically, right, at a good faith installment of a two-state solution would suggest that Palestinian people would have the choice to live where they wanted to live. We have family who is maybe from regions like Haifa, from regions like Akka, who are now restricted to the West Bank and to Gaza, and they are unable to go live in these areas, which means they are unable to participate in this quote-unquote democratic process that exists there, right? So one could say that a good faith attempt would be to allow the safe passage or the mobilization, the ability to live at any location within that region. And this is something that we know the Israeli government has never agreed to. We know that they have intentionally set up blockades to prevent this. And we know that the only reason that can be as such is to ensure that as Palestinians, we do not have a majority of a voice and therefore the ability to direct or steer that government.
Dr. Dubler?
I would only add that, since October 7th and the reading I've done I always thought the Oslo peace process was like a good faith effort but I've come to see it very differently. And so I encourage listeners to really read, and to deconstruct kind of official, narratives. I mean, personally, I don't know how much my opinion on this matters. I'm a diasporist and I'm a Democrat, lowercase d, and I'm not a fan of ethno states. Also, I think the Israeli the illegal settlement expansions of this entire century effectively make a Palestinian state impossible. The attempt to form one would trigger a civil war. You could have a few little Bantustans. So I think greater Israel exists. And it's an apartheid state, right? And this isn't me saying that. This is B'Tselem. This is Human Rights Watch. This is Amnesty International. So the plea I would want to make, but anyway, I'm in community, however, with Jewish people who are committed to a Jewish state. It's not my commitment, but I think I'm in a slightly different place than my friend Jonathan. But here's what I would say to those people who are listening. If you are truly committed to a Jewish state, you need to dedicate all of your efforts to end Israeli apartheid. I don't want you to be talking about Hamas. You need to put the pressure on ending apartheid, ending the militarized rule in the West Bank and in Gaza, even if it's two different forms of militarized rule.
So let me peel back one other aspect of this so I understand where you're coming from. When you say you're generally not a fan of ethnostates to begin with, I understand that. The argument that I often hear and have heard a lot in recent months is that, however imperfectly, and that may be the ultimate euphemism, I understand, but the creation of the Israeli state came after centuries of Jewish people essentially being chased out of wherever their home was, that it became a homeless population targeted for genocide, and that the creation of an ethnostate became a necessity to protect the people. Do you see it that way?
I think that yes. I mean, in the European effort to reckon with the genocide of the Jews during the Shoah was outsourced onto the Palestinian people. So yeah, I have to tell my student. Yes, I think. People who moved on in Aliyah and the kind of quixotic 19th century ideological project of moving to Palestine from Europe, in some sense, like history bore out the wisdom of that. But that project was a 19th century European nationalism, and it was a settler colonialism. So as far as I'm concerned, and I think we differ on this slightly, right? An Israel that existed between 48 borders, right, in the pre-67 borders, would be a crappy state. Kind of like the way the United States is a crappy state, like a former slaveocracy with like massive civil rights problems. But everyone living in that state would have the right to vote. Okay, I could live with, I don't know if you could, I could live with such a thing. What I can't live with as an American taxpayer and as a Jew where this apartheid and genocide is being done in my name is the current configuration where millions and millions of people live under militarized rule and are subject to militarized terror. So again, I would love it. People who identify as self-identified liberal Zionists, I would love to see them put their money where their mouth is and dedicate their entire efforts to ending the occupation. I think there are probably about five such people in the country right now, right? So liberal Zionists mostly are, I think, living in a fantasy world, and they live in a relationship of disavowal where their idea of what Israel is like Joe Biden's idea of what Israel is. And there's a literal wall where they don't look on the other side of the wall about what's happening. I'm very grateful to this. One of the things that gives me hope is the emergence of a young generation of Jewish Americans who are not stopping with the cliches that are being taught. So I encourage, again, people who have committed to a Jewish state who are listening to this, check out this film called Israelism. You know, and I encourage people to have some curiosity about what life is like in the West Bank.
Halima, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think Jewish safety has always been a priority of Palestinian people and of Palestine in general. I think that's why, you know, the area of Palestine was welcoming to Jewish refugees who were escaping persecution, who were escaping their own genocide. And I think that welcoming of refugees and that sanctity and sanctuary that was provided for them was unfortunately taken advantage of. And that's the reality of the history. I think Jewish people have always existed in Palestine. They've always existed in harmony with, you know, the Arabs and the Muslim and Christian Palestinians who have lived there as well. And there's always been this sort of like flux of all of these different religions and ethnicities in the area that were Palestinian, though, that were Palestinian and claimed and knew that that land was Palestine. So even when they welcomed these Jewish refugees, they welcomed them with open arms. And I think, unfortunately, like Jonathan so beautifully said earlier, we have not seen what a peaceful, quote unquote, two-state solution could have looked like because they destroyed that opportunity. There was the opportunity for this. But 1948 came and they decided, and Israel kind of decided to take all of this land, to start the siege, to start occupying what we know as Palestine. So I think, unfortunately, we haven't seen any evidence that it's possible.
So in 25 years from now, which is going to feel like a lifetime away, if the world can get there, and things have moved in the direction that you have finally hoped for, what does it look like there?
It looks like a free and safe Palestine with Jewish people, with Muslim people, with, you know, Palestinians who don't identify with any religion. It looks like a free and safe Palestine, if I'm going to be very honest with you, because I want everyone to be safe, and they were safe when it was just Palestine. They have not been safe. Jewish people are not safe in Israel. They will tell you this themselves, that it's unsafe for them. And existing in this area has now become deadly for everyone involved. And I think if it was going to be my ideal vision, it'd go back to what it was.
I want to welcome on the line, joining us on the line is Sada Al-Jatawi, who is with us, a Palestinian student at the University of Rochester. And Sada, thank you for taking time for us.
Hi, how's everyone doing?
Well, we're having a conversation that I think everyone wishes were different. But we do appreciate you making the time. And Sada, do you want to start by just describing what these recent months have been like for you?
I think that's a very loaded question. I mean, personally, as you said, my family's from Palestine. I have relatives in Gaza right now. And other relatives in the West Bank as well. And it's been, I think, probably one of the worst experiences of my life, witnessing this genocide happen for the last 7 months, and the immense suffering of my people, and just the world's apathy and almost lack of response to what's been happening. And I think it's been a struggle, but we've also seen a lot of solidarity around this cause as well, and a lot of people organizing around it. So I don't want to diminish that at all, but it's definitely been a really, really difficult 7 months at this point, for me personally. But I,
Well, and so let me follow up the point that you're making about some of the solidarity you have seen. You're a student at the University of Rochester, and let me ask Sada about this, but let me ask everyone on this panel about this question. Sada, before you got on this program, you know, some of your colleagues here in the studio talked about how occasionally there's been a challenge to even organizing and protesting and speech. How do you feel your university has acted in response to some of the organized protest effort?
It's been a lot of mixed reactions, but it, as they said, it has been very difficult to let our voices be heard and for us to protest and spread awareness in the way that we want to. It's been very difficult to take up any sort of space at the university or for our concerns to be heard, because part of our mission is, yes, to spread awareness and to educate people who maybe don't know what's going on, and, you know, let people know about what's been happening. But in addition, a lot of what we're asking for is positive change within our own university and within our own community, from administration, from faculty, et cetera. And it's been very difficult to communicate with administration. And in fact, we've seen the opposite, where instead of not only ignoring us, they also will try to suppress our voices by not letting us have events. Or when we do have events, they won't let us say certain things, or they threaten us with disciplinary action. I was personally banned a couple weeks ago, and a lot of my other a couple weeks ago, like things like this. And even we've had administrators come out and say, fully threaten students' futures and say that if you speak up about this, like, beware that your future will be threatened, and comments like that. So it's been very difficult to speak up, and it's honestly beyond disappointing, because at the end of the day, if you've seen all the destruction and the death and what's happening, and you're okay with not saying anything about it, I think it's unreasonable to expect that as students who attend an institution that teaches us about social justice movements, teaches us about positively changing our community and working for a world where people can live in equality and with all their rights given to them, it's disheartening to see that they don't want us to speak up about this, and they're actually unsupportive of it. So, yeah, that's been our experience.
Let me turn to one of your colleagues in studio. Halima Owais is an organizer with the Rochester Committee to End Apartheid and a student at the University of Rochester. How would you assess the university's response?
I would say Sada has nailed it. I think the administration and the university has made it clear that they're really uninterested in what we have to say. We've seen 12 students suspended and 5 students banned from campus. This is their campus. This is our school. I was amongst the students that were banned, just like Sada. And simply only because we are exercising our First Amendment right, because we are attempting to protest and speak about the situation. And I want to also clarify that it's not just for the university to recognize the genocide, right? We've also been calling for the university to assess its own complicitness in this genocide. We've identified it. We've done the research, and we've shown them. We gave a really well-thought-out presentation to all of the faculty at the university and really showed the specific relationships and the specific partnerships that the University of Rochester specifically has with institutions in Israel that are carrying out this genocide. We work directly at the university with weapons manufacturers creating the weapons and tools that are being used to slaughter the Palestinian people. It's more than just we need the university to hear us out. We also need the university to stop carrying this out. They are killing the family members of students at this university, of faculty at this university. And even if these students and faculty were not at the university, It's also just a human rights violation. It's unethical. We're killing people at this point. And the university needs to take a hard look in the mirror and really assess why it's having a hard time hearing us out. All we're doing is asking for them to reassess these relationships and divest where it makes sense. Divest from the relationships that are causing us to murder people, because that's essentially what we're doing, and we're trying to turn a blind eye. And I think the students have had enough, and the students really just want administration to hear us out. I don't think we're asking for much here.
Jonathan, Joshua, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I think that I want to just honor both Halima and Sara and all that they have done at the university, and just want to echo all of the sentiments that they've expressed and offer a little additional context. There's also been dozens of community members who are banned from the University of Rochester for showing up on campus and displaying their solidarity for Palestinian people and engaging in pro-Palestine protests. The University of Rochester seems to have a vested interest in ensuring that no pro-Palestine voices can be on campus in a way that is, in an accessible way. And this isn't something that's unique to the University of Rochester. It's something that we're seeing across the board, right? It's something that we're also seeing and occurred in 12 Corners. At 12 Corners in Brighton, we had a protest, and there was a press release about that protest from the Jewish Federation that was riddled with anti-Palestinian racism, describing and categorizing our peaceful protest as a call for Jewish hate and a call to a call for violence against Jewish people, which has never been a sentiment that any of us have expressed at our protests. As a result of that press release inciting violence against our community and our protesters, someone drove up over an hour and a half from a suburb around it and attacked a Palestinian father that was at this protest, assaulted him, went out of his way as a result of receiving this type of press release, which I also just want to say, I think it's so interesting that as Palestinians, we are always called to answer as to whether or not our calls for freedom depend on the violence against Jewish people, when it's so clear that the establishment of an Israeli state has always depended on violence against the Palestinian people. But nonetheless, since then, a piece of legislation has tried to enter the Brighton Town Board several times, limiting the ability to hold protests at that location or in Brighton in general, in the same way that the university has experienced. At the county level, we've seen the same thing. When we went to the county building and we went to go express our views about how Adam Bello had engaged on this question, tweeting for his support for Israel and making absolutely no mention of the 40,000 lives that have been martyred of the dire humanitarian crisis that has existed, they voted to end the meeting right then and there and have since decided to no longer stream those meetings to ensure that any rhetoric that they don't agree with cannot reach other people. So this is a pattern that we are seeing across the county area, and it's abhorrent.
Joshua.
I appreciate everything my colleague said. You know, foremost, to reiterate the gratitude and appreciation and the solidarity I feel for our students, and the students around the country, for really pointing the way forward here. The gratitude I also feel to my Palestinian brother to my right, and to my colleagues that have stepped up and recognized our unique responsibility as faculty. I want to say a little context about the protests and the repression of protests. Like you might remember, Evan, the first time I sat in this chair, it was because I was bringing a scholar to campus named Stephen Salaita. Right. And Stephen Salaita was a scholar who was blacklisted due to some tweets that he made during the 2014 Israeli incursion into Gaza. Right. Which kind of, you know, came when I came to understand what we might call like the Palestinian exception to free speech in this country. People have talked, I think, in a non-hyperbolic way about the new McCarthyism around this issue. I don't know if you or your listeners read the reporting in the Washington Post last week about the WhatsApp group of billionaires in New York that were communicating with Israeli government officials and looking to pressure Eric Adams to come in and crack skulls on NYU and Columbia's campuses. So that's what we're dealing with here, massive coordinated public and private pressure, both locally and nationally, right? So I believe I've been in communication with senior administration. I think they have been trying to protect the students. I think the pressure they're under is massive. I feel as though they probably feel like they dodged a bullet because they managed to get through the semester with turning the police violence dial up to 3 or 4 rather than 9 or 10. But the police violence dial against students needs to stay at 0. And I am pleased with the conversations that I'm having with other faculty members, both within Faculty for Justice in Palestine and faculty members elsewhere who are determined to push for transparency and accountability about the decision-making processes that have led to the restrictions on free speech, that have led to the bans on community members, and that led ultimately to the exercise of police violence against our students.
And another question, but I'll try to get a little bit of listener feedback in just a moment. One other question I wanted to make sure I let our guests talk about is the fact that President Joe Biden said this week that he fundamentally disagrees with the characterization of what is happening as a genocide. He said that Israel is not conducting a genocide. He said that the population of Palestinians has gone up in recent years, not down, and that you can be critical of Israeli action, and in fact, the Biden administration has done that, saying that if they continue their incursion into other communities, that they will not support it, but he does not view it as a genocide. And I know that you all view that very differently, and I want to give you some space to talk about why you think the president's wrong.
I mean, I find this, and honestly, NPR listeners should find this absolutely shocking. This isn't just Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton who are being absolute reactionaries about the so-called international rules order. This is Joe Biden in support of a credibly indicted war criminal, essentially trashing the set of international institutions that came into being precisely in response to the Holocaust against in Europe between 1941 and 1945, right? This is exceedingly dangerous. Like, I assume your listeners are many of your listeners are very concerned about a Trump presidency. Whatever kind of concern they have, much of this, both in terms of American international policy and domestic policy, much of what they have to fear is already manifest, right? So the International Court of Justice's ruling and the putting down of provisional measures in January, I encourage your listeners to read that document. The evidence provided by South Africa is massive. Please read the document. I listened to the indictments, but I have not read documents from this week's indictment. But again, if there is any kind of international rules-based order, it exists in those institutions. The fact that Biden is willing to trash them is harrowing.
Jonathan?
Yeah, echo everything that my colleague Josh just said. If not a genocide, then what? It's not a war. We know that. We know that there is no war between an occupying power and the people that it occupies. So what else would it be? I think those who want to stay away from the use of the word genocide probably also haven't read the Genocide Convention, which is very clear and has no provision mentioning the rate of population increase or decay being a qualifier for genocide. The language is precise. It is an attempt to destroy in whole or in part any ethnic or civilian population. That is exactly what we are seeing. We are seeing an attempt to destroy the Palestinian people in whole of Gaza or in part by their entirety, remembering that the Palestinians are made up of the West Bank, Gaza, as well as inside of what we call 48 Palestine, what many refer to as Israel. The genocide conventions are clear. The provisions that are the qualifications that are mentioned in the genocide conventions have been met under Netanyahu's rule and have also been supported by Joe Biden. It also is very clear under these conventions that it is not just illegal to commit these acts, but it is also illegal to support these acts in any way. So I don't know why Joe Biden Biden would be willing to admit that he himself has broken international law and by supporting the act of genocide. I think it is. I don't think it is very important, Joe Biden's opinion on whether or not he meets the qualification for trespassing on the Genocide Convention. I don't know why he would be willing to admit so. But what we know is that he has. What we know is that Israel has.
Well, what Secretary of State Blinken recently said was that the toll of the siege has been tragic, and it would be much less if Hamas didn't build their infrastructure inside schools and hospitals. That's what the Secretary of State
said. There is yet to be any empirical evidence to suggest that Hamas has infrastructure built in any of these areas. The burden of proof is on Israel, not on the people that are being bombarded, not on the people that are being slaughtered by the Israeli regime. I don't know how else to show. I don't know how else the Palestinian people are meant to show that their civilian, their hospitals, their schools, their UN schools do not have Hamas bases hidden in the closets. It is Israel's responsibility to show that that is the case, and they have failed to do so.
Halima, do you want to add to this?
No, I think that was said perfectly. I think it might be a bit pedantic to review the definition of genocide, but it is to deliberately kill a group of people of some ethnicity with the intent of wiping them out. And that's what we see. When you have indiscriminate bombing of hospitals, schools, refugee camps, children's schools, then what else do we call that? Because Hamas isn't there and the fighters aren't there. So who really are they after? They are after the Palestinian civilians and they're attempting to wipe them out. It's really point blank what it is.
I'll only add, sorry, I know I already spoke, but the ICC indictments from this week do not charge genocide, but they do explicitly charge mass starvation and starvation as a weapon of war, mm-hmm. which picks up on some of the provisional measures from the ICJ from January, right? It is very clear that the provisional measures mandated opening access to humanitarian aid. Israel has been operating a mass starvation campaign for 7 months.
And Sada, do you want to add to this as well?
I just to echo, like, exactly what they said is exactly how I think as well. And in addition, not only just withholding aid and food and water, but also they're not allowing Palestinians to move out of Gaza, to move out of the line of fire. Yes, they'll move them. They'll tell them to evacuate, but at this point, there is nowhere to evacuate. And even if they were able to go, they have to walk on foot with all their children, with all their things. It's very clear that there is a disregard for Palestinian life in any way, shape, or form. And I think that, if anything, would constitute this, like Jonathan said, what else would you call this? If you are not allowing people to get aid, if you are not allowing people to leave to go get medically treated or to get aid, and if you're not allowing them to go leave to not be in the line of fire, then what is your goal here? And like Halima said, I mean, schools, hospitals, mosques, churches, these are community centers, infrastructures that are integral to any society, and that's what's being targeted. I really do not know how else you could describe this as. And I think the world's refusal to use the word genocide says a lot about how we're characterizing and this narrative and what we're displaying, because, I mean, even on campus, the first event that I wanted to do to just educate people about what was happening in Palestine, I was told by the administrator that the use of the word genocide was inflammatory and incites violence. But I think not calling it for what it is allows people to run away from accountability and run away from holding our leaders accountable for what they're contributing to this.
Let me say, before I read an email and get ready to wrap the program today, that this is a part of an ongoing series of conversations on this program about these related issues. This will not be the only one. This is not the first one. There have been Jewish voices on this program. There will be Jewish voices in the future. There will be Palestinian voices in the future. There will be leaders of faith in the future. There will be people who probably share exactly the view that whatever it is that you hold, and there will be people who do not. And we're going to continue to do that. Ideally, we're going to try to do that in ways that are constructive, mm-hmm. which means at least helping elucidate and not obfuscate. That's not always easy, and I don't always succeed. I fail often, but I'm glad that our listeners here, our panelists here today, are at least sharing their perspective. And I want to read an email from Mona Halim. She says, from the Palestinian perspective, I'm wondering if any comment has been made Looking at Hamas and the IRA, the IRA was considered a terrorist organization, but full-blown war was not waged against the Irish people, as it is now being waged against the Palestinian people by the State of Israel. Also, ultimately, the IRA was accepted as a political force as Sinn Féin. Terrorism is not and should not be endorsed, but seems like different rules apply to different, quote-unquote, terrorist groups. That's from Mona. Dr. Dubler, you're nodding? You agree with that?
Yeah, I appreciate the contribution. I was suggesting something similar earlier. I think that's right.
Okay. And Jonathan, you and I have been in touch for a number of weeks as we got ready for this program. And I've got a minute left, and I just want to give you the floor if you want to leave listeners with some final thoughts.
Continue to engage in this question. Continue to speak to Palestinians. Continue to speak to Jewish people. Continue to recognize the difference between Zionism and Judaism. And we are more than happy to address any of those questions at the Rochester Committee to End Apartheid. We're always happy to engage in this conversation. And Evan, we'd really appreciate you inviting us onto the show.
You'll be invited in the future. We appreciate that. Dr. Dupler, some final thoughts?
Only thank you.
Okay. Halima?
No, thank you for having us, and I'm glad we could open this conversation once again in the city of Rochester. I think people have an appetite for continue to talk about this, so thanks for having us.
Sada, some final thoughts from you?
Thank you so much as well. If you ever need a student voice, I'm more than happy to contribute, and I'm glad that this conversation is being brought up now. However, this is an issue that's been occurring for the last 76 years now, so, yep.
Thank you for making time. Thank you, Sada. I appreciate it. Our thanks to our guests in studio, Halima Awais, who's an organizer with the Rochester Committee to End Apartheid and a student at the University of Rochester. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Joshua Dubler, Associate Professor of Religion at the University of Rochester and a member of the U of R's Chapter of Faculty for Justice in Palestine. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
Jonathan Corey, a Palestinian organizer with the Rochester Committee to End Apartheid. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have more connections coming up in just a moment.